Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Ask the experts about free fitting on all our kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Now, self-help bookshelves and social media are stacked full of advice on brain hacking, how to optimise ourselves, how to be productive so that we are finally happy. But what if instead of battling our brain, the secret is to make your brain your best friend? Well, that's the idea posed by neuroscientist Rachel Barr in her new book, How to Make Your Brain Your Best Friend. And she joins me now. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Claire. Cheers for having me.
I'm delighted to have you and congratulations on your new book. And I saw on your Instagram that you only really appreciated the fact that you'd written a new book when you went into a shop and paid for it.
Yeah, gosh, it's a bizarre experience writing a book because you just do it all by yourself. And it felt real, I suppose, for the first time seeing it in a shop.
So take us back then to your decision to put the book together in the first place. Why do it?
Well, a couple of reasons. The first is that, you know, I've been in neuroscience for years and years and years, and increasingly I've noticed that the conversations that we're having about mental health in public spaces have nothing to do with what I know about the brain. And having watched my mum really struggle with her mental health, which in the end she didn't survive it, I've kind of realised that people need to know how to take care of their brains. There's a real lack of good information out there, and people are trying to look after their brains, of course, but with all the wrong advice. Mm-hmm.
And do you think in general terms the message that we're getting from a lot of self-help literature and a lot of what we're seeing online is that you have to go into battle with your brain? You know, you have to discipline your brain. You have to wrangle your brain to do things that you want it to do.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so much of the advice that we're given in the wellness space is actually about extracting yet more labour, more productivity from drained bodies and mind. And there's this, all the language around brain stuff, it tends to be hack your brain as if it's, you know, a machine. You can hack into submission, but of course it's not. That's not how the brain functions. And part of the reason I've called the book How to Make Your Brain Your Best Friend, and I mean, throughout the book, I kind of anthropomorphize the brain, describe it like a little pet that you're charged with caring for, is because I think that changes how people approach self-care. You know, this idea of like hacking your brain to submission, the absurdity of that, I think, becomes clear the instant you apply that to any other living thing. So if your dog or your child is acting out, you don't go online looking for advice about how to hack them into submission. You know, you try to understand their distress, hopefully, and provide care and kindness.
I have to say, reading your book, it felt like, you know, when your shoulders are tense and you might be, you know, uptight, reading your book makes you feel like relaxing down, releasing a slow breath, because your message really is to be compassionate to yourself.
Yeah, that's lovely to hear, because that's exactly what I want readers to feel. And I mean, the stress of daily life now, that hunched shoulders feeling, I mean, we're walking around or sitting at our desks more often, hunched like that all the time. We're always stressed. So like, I love that was how you felt reading. Mm-hmm.
That chapter you write about finding delight in everyday things. I mean, it is such a simple concept, but one that makes complete sense, that you would make it your business every day to find something that makes you feel delighted and happy. And for you, I know it's cats, but for other people, it could be something completely different, right?
Yeah, cats are a popular one, though. I think that they're a pretty universal source of delight animals, aren't they? Yeah, I talk about microdosing delight throughout every day. And we rarely hear discussions of delight in wellness spaces or even at all. But actually, I think it's an incredibly important human experience. We're creatures that need to be delighted regularly.
So find something that makes you happy or that makes you smile? I mean, how would you define what you want people to microdose on?
Yeah, it's a strange one to like, because there's almost an element of surprise in it. It is a pleasant experience, but it's not quite pleasure. Sometimes delightful things also happen to be pleasurable as well, but there is an element of spontaneity about it. And so part of the microdosing delight is you've got to give yourself moments of the day where, first of all, you're in spaces where you're likely to be delighted. So I talk about the Cat Cafe in Bristol that I used to go to, and where you're not distracted. You kind of have to be looking about you, not with your face in your phone, ready to catch delight whenever it appears. And of course, we're perpetually distracted now.
Mm-hmm. And our poor old brains, they're not equipped to deal with that perpetual distraction, are they? I mean, not equipped to deal with the modern world, you could say.
No, not at all. I was having this discussion with a neuroscientist friend of mine yesterday that we see the world as a brain mite. And it's hard not to see how hostile it is, the world that we've built for our brains to navigate. I mean, first of all, we're tasked with processing more information on a daily basis than ever before in human history. We're not really built for that. We're not built for the chronic stress. We're not built for the lives of isolation that we're now living. People are very lonely. You know, we don't have these self-assembling communities. We're working remotely. We're spending more time alone. And I mean, it's the worst possible thing that you can do for a human brain.
And you write about, I mean, you're very concerned about loneliness in this modern age. I mean, you say it's on a par with obesity and smoking in terms of mortality risk. And maybe you might explain to us a little more about the neuroscience behind that, why we need each other so much.
Yeah, I mean, also, our brains have been shaped through social evolution. It's one of the major factors that went into shaping our human brains throughout our evolution. To be exiled from the group meant you were toast. You simply wouldn't survive without the help and the protection of your family and your tribe. So even now in the modern age, the brain interprets loneliness as kind of an ongoing threat environment. And so you stay in kind of a perpetual state of chronic stress. You've got chronic stress hormones pumping through your body. You go into a pro-inflammatory state because your body thinks you're likely to be injured any moment now because you're not with your tribe. And of course, that then has knock-on effects for cardiovascular health and all-cause mortality, just like smoking and obesity.
And Rachel, if you become more and more isolated, then it's harder to break out of that, isn't it?
Yeah, so that's what I talk about in the chapter about socializing and loneliness, is that unfortunately our brains adapt to long stretches of loneliness, not by upgrading our skills to find connection, but actually by eroding them. So there are a bunch of different adaptations that happen in the brain that then make it yet more difficult for us to connect with other people, and sometimes can dampen our desire to even try.
Yeah, so how then do you convince yourself that it is safe to try to connect with people?
Yeah, I mean, I talk about holding that awareness. Of course, that doesn't solve the problem. It's a bit like don't think of a red balloon. But I think simply being aware that that's happening in your brain, if you're going through a stretch of loneliness in your life, I call it self-preservation mode, all those adaptations in the brain that make it harder for us to connect. Simply holding that awareness, you know, if you think everybody hates you and, oh, it looks like everybody doesn't like me, and you're interpreting social signals as hostile all the time, telling yourself this might be self-preservation mode, just trying to give yourself and the people around you a little bit of benefit of the doubt, I think that can meaningfully reduce its power over you.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I got the sense when you write about that time in your life when you went to study neuroscience, having come from a sports science background, I would imagine that was a pretty lonely time because you were with people who had done their undergraduate degree in that neurological area, and here you were coming in from sports science. Did you feel a bit lost in that time?
Yeah, I mean, just a quick shout out, because my master's cohort were amazing. Like, I have so much love for those people, so that helped a lot. But I mean, loneliness has been kind of a main artery through my whole life. And certainly during that time, because I was studying all the time, I was very lonely. But for me, I'm autistic as well. So it's been harder for me to make friends throughout life. And I certainly am very familiar with loneliness.
Mm-hmm. And how have you managed that?
Well, I mean, it's like any human being. You go out and you try and you make yourself vulnerable and you know, you keep trying mm-hmm. and you weather the rejection. You've just got to go out and keep trying.
I like how you talk about trying new hobbies as well and it being okay if you hate it. if you don't like something, you shouldn't feel that you should like it, that there's something wrong with you, that I don't like playing basketball. It just might not be your thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like that's kind of a recurring theme throughout the book as well, is like helping people to sort of build themselves or find themselves, however you want to phrase it. And this idea of just like exploration and approaching things with curiosity, trying things, going to the figure drawing class, realizing you hate it, but then maybe having made a friend that you just like go to the pub with afterwards instead.
Mm-hmm. And that's okay. And we need to give ourselves a break with many of these things, because we are inclined, aren't we, to beat ourselves up a lot when things don't work out.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of moralistic posturing that goes on, just that humans are like that. But I think it's amplified now in the age of social media, that we're just like constantly made to feel like we should be this and we should be doing that and we should like this, that and the other. And of course, we're all very wonderfully individual.
And when we are scrolling on social media, or doom scrolling, as people call it, like what's happening in our brains then?
Yeah, so I mean, the reason that we're drawn to it is because we process some of what happens on social media. Our brain processes it as a social reward. And so because it's potentially rewarding, that kicks our dopamine system into gear. And the way that reward signaling works is it's called prediction error encoding. When you're at the casino, when you're on the slot machine, every time you lose, your brain thinks it's going to get a reward. It doesn't get a reward. It downregulates dopamine signaling for the next time, updates its model. But then when you finally get that win and you weren't expecting it, boom, like dopamine signaling goes nuts and your brain upregulates dopamine signaling for the next time. So it keeps us in this, this loop.
Yeah, I mean, you can
reward searching.
I can see how that would be damaging. And then if you put that against your let's find a little bit of delight, whether that's in the natural world or whatever it might be, that's a much easier thing for the brain to deal with, is it?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Just using your description of the dopamine hit, the highs and the lows of scrolling through social media, putting that in context against what you've talked about when it comes to finding delight in everyday things, how does that compare, Rachel, in terms of how it impacts the brain?
Yeah, so because delight, we don't crave delight. That it's not like an embodied hedonic pleasure or reward in that sense. So we never crave delight. And we're also not anxious about it. So there are very few kind of motivating factors to remind us to go out and search for it, which is why we've got to remind ourselves, we, the human hosts.
Rachel, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much. And I'd advise people to find you on social media, not when you're doom scrolling. If you're looking for delight, maybe go and find Rachel on social media. The book is called How to Make Your Brain Your Best Friend, and it's out now. Rachel Barr, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks so much.